Welcome to the Corporate Treasury 101 podcast. In today's episode, we'd have Matt Cornwell from Chubb, and we discuss how in his previous company, his treasury department went under a cyber attack, had to go through COVID as a travel provider, and a fraud situation all within a six-month period. Matt is a highly ambitious professional with qualifications in SEMA and AMCT specializing in treasury. With a wealth of experience in treasury, accounting, and commercial roles, Matt has successfully navigated diverse industry sectors within blue-chip global companies. With over 25 years, he has showcased robust operational treasury management skills, leading transformative changes within organizations, and, as you're about to hear, carrying organizations through very turbulent times. In this episode, expect to learn what were the immediate actions that Matt took after a cyber attack ensued, and what are the precautions that you need to take when communicating with banks and stakeholders in such an environment? In his previous company, TravelX, what were the immediate operations that were managed during COVID, during the cyber attack, during the fraud attack, and by the way, getting audited at the same time? What were the strategies that Matt used with his employees in keeping them motivated and preventing panic during these successive crises and much more? We hope you enjoy the episode. And if that's the case, then if you probably heard about our podcast through word of mouth, or maybe you were recommended by the podcast platforms. And one of the things that they love is reviews. So we'd love it if you could go off and leave us a five-star review wherever you're listening to this show. It really helps the show and helps us get treasury and knowledge and education in front of more and more people. And with that, here's Matt Cornwell. Matt, thank you so much for coming on the Corporate Treasury 101 podcast.
I'm pleased to be here.
Super excited to go into your story. I think there's going to be loads and loads of gems and lessons to learn out of your experience, right? And then we're going to touch on a little bit more detail. But before we get started, give us your background. So who is Matt Cornwell? Where is he from? Where did he come from? And how did you end up in Treasury?
Yeah, I'll try and cover that in a minute or two. So I started my career probably too long ago now, but over 25 years ago as a chartered accountant. Did that for about 9 years, working for a couple of reasonable sized companies, and then joined corporate treasury actually a year before the global financial crisis. So that was about 15, 16 years ago. Since then, I've worked for companies such as Virgin Atlantic, what is now Dixon's Carphone, P&O, the shipping line, and also Capita, and the company I'm about to talk to more about, TravelX, the foreign exchange company.
Super cool. So tell us a little bit about that transition. Like, how did you end up in treasury from accounting? We always say that, you know, most people wind up in treasury. They don't usually intentionally go towards treasury. But how did that switch happen for you?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm often asked that from younger members of my team as well. So I was group accountant at a media company that was highly acquisitive and had a very small London team, but most of the operations were in Europe. There was really only less than a dozen of us. And obviously, as the company grew very quickly, it grew from an AIM listed company to FTSE 250 in about 18 months, which was a huge rate of growth. So obviously, we needed a treasury function, and we recruited a treasurer. And I was asked if I wanted to support him, because I had a very overarching remit on the accounting side. And to be honest, I think after 9 years, you know, in the accounting world, it's an area that can be a bit repetitive in terms of, you know, annual budgets, annual forecasts, year end, month end, all that type of thing. It felt a bit of a hamster wheel. So, you know, I was really actually looking for something else and more of an outlet that would be more forward thinking. Accounting can be a bit backward looking. So, I knew a bit about treasury, not that much. And the opportunity came up and I took it. And not really looked back since. I certainly would never feel I would want to go back to accounting. And also, I think treasury is so varied, even in the 16 years I've been doing it, there's so much there that you can link in with very broadly geopolitics, you know, macroeconomics, but even down to the very small detail of cash management with your banks and payment technology. There's such an array of different areas you can go into treasury. That's why I really do like it and like pushing it forward as a career as well for people.
Out of interest, just because it's been something we've been talking a lot in the past, did you do any like formal qualifications in your transition from being an accountant towards treasury, or did you feel the need to do that? What was the advantages of that?
Yeah, I mean, I did the CEMA qualification for a chartered accountancy, and then I very much thought, well, at a younger age, you can learn and absorb better. And I thought, if I'm going to do this, I want to do this now, and took the AMCT qualification with the ACT bodies. So fully qualified treasurer as well. And I always say that I think qualifications are certainly good. They do open doors. They're a passport to accelerate your career, but they're not always, you know, absolutely crucial to progress. I think it's more about, you know, your ability to have an open mind and really be hungry to learn. That's certainly key in Treasury, as I said, because it's so varied. But really, the qualification side, I think, you know, in terms of recruitment, as I said, it can be a passport to get that next rung on the ladder in terms of career. But once you're in a role, I think it's less important, and it's more about the operational and technical and even strategic experience you have in Treasury that makes you progress.
Super cool. So, and how do you develop that? Is that just time on the job and going through enough horror stories, or is it? Do you think there's ways you can get?
You hear some today, but I think it's about that natural curiosity, the ability to learn, as well as the enthusiasm to learn, and also just putting yourself forward. For, you know, I think there's a lot more projects within Treasury. There's a lot more business enhancement and business process projects that you can get involved with that can involve lots of different areas of the company. So you can't just sit in a corner and do nothing in Treasury. You've got to really put yourself out there. And that's the thing I always advise to help progress your career more once you're in a job, that is.
So using that as a transition into what we're going to get in today. So you mentioned at your time at TravelX, and we got acquainted at the Treasury Career Corner Live, where you were on stage talking about Treasury careers and hybrid work and all these things. But you alluded to a very rough time that you had at TravelX, specifically a very rough 6 months period, where you went through a cyber attack event, you found fraud at the parent company that the company was at, and of course, being a travel company, COVID-19, I'm sure, had a very interesting effect on certainly Treasury activities, if not the entire company. So take us through all of that. So start with the cyber attack. It's New Year's Eve. You're working at TravelX for about a year now. How long had you been there?
About 9 months at that time.
About 9 months. So what happened?
Yes, so New Year's Eve, I think the majority of people were working from home even then. It was pre-COVID times. It was the Christmas period. Literally, the phone went red hot. I turned the phone on. There were emails, text messages, missed calls. And obviously, the cyber attack had happened already on Asia time, so earlier in the day. And, you know, I'm no technical expert, but from what I do know is that it was a ransomware attack. It was something that would encrypt hard drives for wherever those servers sat, and it hit first offices in Asia, went all the way from New Zealand across to the west coast of the US. It was believed in a matter of hours, and infected all of our point of sale systems, as well as, you know, the everyday laptop for the office worker as well in the company. It was pretty much ubiquitous over the whole system architecture for TravelX. And the way they got in was a weakness in the VPN. It was actually something that had been highlighted only 3 months before within the computer press and those that sometimes they even stretch companies' networks to try and find deficiencies or weaknesses. So it was something the senior management knew about, but obviously, you know, it's very hard to protect against everything. And I think it required a lot of investment to try and fix that. Yeah, that going back to the day, it was New Year's Eve. It was literally 8 a.m. We had a call with the senior leadership trying to ascertain what had happened. It was blatantly clear because everybody who turned their computer on that day, who was working that day, could not do a thing. Here's a tagline for you. Your laptop was as useful as a Frisbee, was what I kept hearing. Every single Microsoft product was disabled. We were, as time went by, literally hours went by, we were all advised not to open up any application at all. And you were typically faced with that message of the malware attack that we later found out was Russian organized crime. The Russian mafia were behind this, and a well-known cyber attacker that you know, people would know if they've been ever impacted by this. What do you do when that happens? You can't access email, any Microsoft product. You can't contact your team. You can't look at your TMS. You know, banking platforms still work because they were in the cloud and web-enabled, so we could still see our balances, which was good. But literally the whole infrastructure of how you work was disabled and you couldn't do anything. So we very quickly had to come up with a contingency plan and put not a finer point on it, we had to run the company via WhatsApp.
End-to-end encrypted.
Yes, true, exactly. But, you know, I put it mildly, but, you know, I had a team up in Peterborough, a very good team, and a team of about 20 between there and London. And some were of a mature age that didn't even know what WhatsApp was. So you're having to educate people in a new social platform to then, you know, give out instructions, guidance, actually stop people from panicking as well. Because, you know, the moment you see how your whole job is governed through your computer systems, all of that is turned off. What do you do? It's a very odd situation. And bring it to light, obviously the point of sale systems were all corrupted as well. So, you know, Travelex had the contracts within the major multiples. So if you buy currency for your holiday in Tesco, Sainsbury's or Asda, that is actually not from the supermarket. It's Travelex white labeling their FX product. So all of those were offline. As we started getting the company up on its feet, there was a stage where orders had to be taken simply with paper and pen. Became that prehistoric in how we just kept the wheels running and managing the company. I'll pause there a minute in case there's a question, but I wanted to go into you know, how we actually managed the treasury operation. I think that's probably a...
Yeah, that's what I'd like to hear more about. So, like, what did you... I guess when you're faced with a crisis situation like that, where your main operation of working is just completely gone, I'm guessing you need to consolidate down on, you need to figure out what are the core operations that we cannot stop, right? And how do we do those? So what were those? Like, what was going through your head at the time as, like, the leader of a treasury organization there? What was going through your head at that time?
Well, if we focus on the personal element, I mean, the point is that at a time like that, you have completely incomplete information. You don't know what you can and can't do. You don't know what resource you have. You don't know what your priority is next, really. So that was really the first step, was to understand, okay, what is our capability? What can and we can't do? So as I said already, our banking platforms were still working. We could make payments. We could get visibility over our balances. But at the same time, you know, we run the company on a reasonably tight shoestring in terms of liquidity. We had a credit facility, but that was almost fully drawn. It was obviously at year end, so the cash balances were of a certain position that wouldn't be typical for that time of the rest of the year. And also, you know, I think any treasurer would agree, your number one priority is keeping the cash flow and keeping the liquidity available, because you just don't know what's coming next. And also, you have no idea how long this problem is going to last. Is it going to be a few days? Is it going to be a few weeks or even longer? So it's an old adage in Treasury that you prepare for the worst and hope for the best. It's that cliche, really. So, it's a combination of what your capability is. We could make payments. We could see balances. What was our priority? It was liquidity management, making sure we had enough working capital to keep the business going. And probably not really in a priority, but getting the communication out to the teams, to the operations teams, and my own individual team, to make sure that people knew what to do next. And, you know, some people thought, right, we're just down tools until I get a phone call from the boss. You've got to keep the momentum going so that you are ready when things come back online. But at the same time, you don't know when that point's going to happen. So there's a massive amount of uncertainty. And it's very hard to explain that, because it's, you know, your whole lifeblood for the company is and cash management, especially when we were running things very tightly anyway. So you're completely blindsided, and it's quite scary, to be honest, when you're faced with that, really, because there's so much unknown about the situation.
I'm going to make a very weird comparison here. Have you watched the TV show The Walking Dead?
Yes, I've seen a few episodes.
So people are going to be wondering where the hell he's going with this. So when I watched The Walking Dead, everyone turned into zombies. I think that TV show did really well, was make you realize if there's a zombie apocalypse, the zombies are the immediate threat. And that's what you think is what's going to kill you. But actually, as time goes on, you realize it's actually other humans that are more dangerous, because it becomes lawless almost. And it's kind of this, like, oh, okay, the zombies were bad, but then this problem over here that you perhaps didn't even realize is actually lurking there as well. Did you have anything like that? So you thought, like, okay, we can't even work. How are we going to make our, you know, payments? You're a treasurer in a foreign, like an FX company, right? Like, that's like the whole company is a treasury company in a certain way, right? There's aspects of financial risk management to take care of. There's all these operations that you take care of in a large way. And I'm sure the immediate repercussions of liquidity management as ransomware, like, There could be, they just call up and say, I need this much cash. That cash needs to be available if you're going to be paying it off, which, by the way, at the end of it, you need to tell us if you actually paid them or not. But were there any like second order effects that came out of that people maybe you never imagined or most people would be surprised to hear?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, certainly, yes, you have all those immediate thoughts I said earlier, but then it's how people behave and then also how your stakeholders behave is what you can't really foresee. So to break that down into two areas, I mean, certainly I'd say that the senior management were very, very good in terms of A, getting a specialist consultant involved very early. I mean, there is legislation in this country where you have to let the ICO know within 72 hours of a cyber attack. So you have to move very quickly and get the expertise in quickly. So we had a consultants firm, maybe even two of them, that we almost became in-house for about 2 months for the month of January and February. So not losing sight of the question. The other area is, you know, there was a lot of solidarity. We had very close links with our banks, but not only as providers, but also customers. We provided all the FX and currency for the main UK high street banks in delivering the banknotes to them. And, you know, there was a lot of, okay, an initial knee-jerk reaction, are any of the Travelex systems connected with the banks? We need to terminate those as quickly as possible. But also solidarity in terms of, well, look, we need you as a vendor as much as you need us as a customer. How do we continue the wheels going round? How do we actually help? And that solidarity was good. You know, obviously no banks are charity, but there was certainly a lot more help than I would have ever thought initially at that stage. As, you know, this is only the period of probably 72 hours, as the news hit and became more widely known, the BBC, the FT, some very large organisations started wanting to get from the horse's mouth what had happened. They were interviewing people who were sat in those FX bureaus that really didn't have a lot to do, and some people had an axe to grind about the company for, you know, past problems that had nothing to do with the cyber attack. So that was something I don't think anyone would have predicted, that people saw that as an outlet. I can say exactly what I like about my company and not really think about it. HR had to move very quickly. There was communications going around that they didn't want people talking to the press, and anybody caught doing so could be disciplined, that type of thing. So you've got to bring in an enormous amount of discipline, because suddenly your company becomes a bit uncontrollable because all your systems aren't working or not connected as well. I'm sure there's probably lots of other areas, but I'm trying to keep it succinct, really. I think as well, you can't judge or guess or second guess how humans are going to behave in situations like that. And I am glad to say a lot of people were calm and collected. But at the same time, that only works if you give clear direction and clear communication. And often too much communication is wrong. You have to give out, you know, very summarized or limited communication about what happens next. So I'll leave it on there, that question. But I think overall, yes, there was more unknowns than... But no, I saw the analogy, what you mean, that the threat immediate is not actually the biggest threat. I get what you mean there.
Is that the way you thought I was going to ask about The Walking Dead? Did you have something else in mind? That was a better question. I could get...
Liquidity management.
Nice. And so from a treasury perspective, because that's interesting, because when I was asking that question, I thought, I mean, we have these four fundamentals of corporate treasury. That's how we break down treasury, which is cash and liquidity management, financial risk management. There was another one. And then bank relations, right? And then bank relations. And then relationships are also a lot built on trust. I thought that maybe you would even see people like start treating you, start keeping a 10-foot pole away from you to say, look, you guys are infected, right? You can't come near us. Sort your stuff out, then maybe we'll talk. But until then, we need to go somewhere else. And then maybe some of those services, that core infrastructure, to fulfill your treasury operations, to do the liquidity management that you said, the working capital management that you needed to do, perhaps would have gotten more difficult. But I'm glad to hear it was a lot more banding together.
At least initially. I'll come on to how that changed, though. But yeah, if anything, what you described, Sam, was almost a known unknown, that we realised that banks would A, want to pull the plug on any system connection, and B, suddenly review our credit risk a lot more. But you know, Barclays was our main bank. We were termed as a gold-plated customer. I think that just means they made a lot of money out of the company. We had to be careful what I say now, but, you know, I was very, very conscious of, you know, we were paying above market pricing for our credit facility, for example. We had 18 billion of derivatives trades that we did annually, and they were very small, to be honest. We used to hedge very frequently, but small values constantly during the day, typically with an automated tool through a TMS. So you can imagine the banks loved us because we were doing, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of trades every week for a company that wasn't that large, really, with about a billion market cap. We were, as I said, derivative trades totaling about $18 billion. So it was a huge flow of FX trades, and that's why the banks treated us carefully, but at the same time didn't want to lose that relationship. So I think that's where a bit of solidarity came from. The moment the banks knew about this, there was lots of calls, lots of meetings. And really the theme was, well, you know, within reason, what can we do for you to keep the wheels turning? But saying that, I mean, there was one really key point. It was within the first week this happened. The relationship manager at Barclays, someone I got on very well with, who remained nameless, I caught up with him for a beer a couple of years after the event, and he said, Matt, that day that I gave you that phone call will always stick in my head as a career-defining moment or a completely big milestone he'll always remember. And that was, Barclays are well aware that we had to pay a ransom. He called me up. This was after he'd had a conversation with the CEO with Barclays, Jess Staley, and he said, Matt, you don't have to confirm or deny if you're going to pay the ransom. Don't for 1 minute think you'll do it through one of our bank accounts. And when you hear that, you'd think, right, well, how the hell are we going to pay it then? Because we didn't have a very large banking panel. The other point I was going to raise linked to that was when other treasurers have asked me to talk about how you cope with this cyber attack, I always put one question to them that say, right, you have to pay a ransom by this Friday. You know, this is in the public domain. It was about $6 million, not huge on the grand scheme of things. You have to pay that within a few days in Bitcoin to a very small regional bank on the west coast of the US, I think California. You know, a bank you would never normally hit your credit risk thresholds, for example. And yeah, I've never had an answer to that. Like, well, how did you do it, Matt? Because there's so many red lights and question marks on how we did it, you know.
How did you do it? Come on, you got to ask that.
Am I building up the apprehension? So TravelX just couldn't do it. We did not have the means to do it. Our bank had simply said, look, you do that, it's going to hit every single sanction screening filter and all the red lights will start flashing. So our parent in the UAE, they did it through one of their accounts. And I don't know exactly how it was done. I mean, they obviously used a bank with maybe more lap sanction controls, allegedly. But the front office dealer that actually did it, I spoke to him after, and he said it. He got through to a person that acted on behalf of those that planted the malware attack. And he said, he'll never forget that conversation. It was like ringing in a call center because the person he was speaking to was actually in a rush because they had to clock off at 5 p.m. that day. It was that much of a mechanized industry, you know, sort of arrangement. Unbelievable, really. And he had to confirm the wire of the $6 million. Equally, they had to confirm receipt. And then that was passed through to the bad actors that all started the little problem, really.
How do you heal from that as a organization, as a treasury department? So you've paid the ransom, it came through, you in your treasury sphere couldn't do it, your bank said no, you had to outsource it to your parent company, they took care of it. What happens from there? So you hear the news, money's been transferred, do laptops just suddenly all switch on? Like, what is everyone going through? How do you walk into work the next day and look everyone in the eye? What do you say?
At the time, there was only a small group of five or six of us that knew we were going to go ahead with our action. And yeah, it sadly isn't the case that everyone's laptop all works again and it's all back to normal. There were meetings at least three or four times a day with the main cyber risk consultant in explaining what happens and what the ransom's paid purely for a key that decrypts your data. And that's customer data as well as internal corporate data. But again, another analogy I come up with when I've talked about this in the past is it's a bit like, you know, if you were mugged in King's Cross and you got a phone call from that mugger saying, would you like to meet me and I'll give you back your wallet? You wouldn't do it, would you?
I don't know.
I mean, you tell me, would you go and you have to meet at that night with the mugger and ask for your wallet?
But what's the condition? Why?
But at the same time, you know, there were negotiations going on through our cyber risk consultant with the hacker. But of course, you don't know if, A, the data they're going to return is going to be complete, the key actually works, if they haven't made a copy of all your data, or even, you know, it only decrypts half of your what's on your hard drives and actually the information you need. You have no idea. You're putting all your trust in the person that has committed the crime. And that is a very odd relationship. Now, luckily, the key did decrypt everything, and we did start getting things back online. But, I mean, it's hard after 4 years remembering how long exactly, but it took about 4 to maybe 8 weeks to get the company back on its feet. And, of course, you're dealing with the problem of reputational damage. You know, will customers still go to you? Will they even transact with you with a credit card, for example? And all the relationships you have to rebuild with your banks, with your all your other vendors. And then even internally, you've got to worry that suddenly people are going to leave because they can see that the company might fail. You know, there's so many different battles to have and different areas to manage. Not enough time to really go into all of those. But.
Crazy. That's amazing. But so don't go into all of them. Like I said, what do you say to your team the first Monday back in? Like, how long is this being discussed for? What happened specifically inside your treasury team?
Yeah, there was a lot of, again, even solidarity at a smaller level. And I think it, yeah, maybe it's a cliche, but the bit of British stiff upper lip, you know, we're going to get through this. It doesn't matter what they throw at us. We're going to keep going. And, you know, that was good. I think when people are faced with adversity as well, you never really know, A, how they're going to behave, but also how resilient people can be when your back's against the wall. And I was lucky with my team. There was a lot that had been there for many years. Travelex was there. You know, whole backbone to them, their family. They really wanted to do everything they possibly could to get things up and running again. And it was a real stoicism, I think the word is I'm looking for. So, yeah, I was very conscious during that time to keep people motivated, to keep people, you know, I had no idea how it was going to continue and how long it would last. But at the same time, it was very much choosing which battle you'd fight, taking one step at a time, and making sure, going back to what I said right at the beginning, you recognise what you can and you can't do and don't really worry about what you can't control. I think that's probably a lesson in life anyway. Deal with what you can control and what you can have an effect on. That's so important. But I think, actually going back to an earlier question you had, you know, things we didn't recognise or even visualise was, you know, making payments. You all companies have a whole control framework over payments. You know, you have dual signatories, you have segregation of duties, all those type of things. All of that went out the window and we had to replace with manual processes, which slows everything down. But again, you had to think about what the priorities were, which were the big payments to make, with one eye on that and the other eye on liquidity in the company and making sure that you're not paying out more than you're getting in. And of course, systems would normally tell you that. But yeah, landscape of moving parts, very, very hard to manage, really.
No, indeed. So you've just gone through that. It's been a bit of a, to say the least, traumatic time, I'm sure, for the company overall. Shortly afterwards, there's another financial crime that occurs inside the same company. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so if we rewind back to autumn 2019, there was a hedge fund that started scrutinising the financial statements for a sister company not linked to Travelex or its parent, a company called NMC Health, actually a FTSE 100 company at the time. The financial records were scrutinised to a very high degree by the hedge fund. They picked up misrepresentations and, you know, certainly started to question the integrity of the numbers. It turned out that there were balances being inflated, not properly evidenced. Even the auditors were brought into this. In short, that company was worth $10 billion in 2019. Within about 8 months, it was worth like 1% of that. The whole company model got ripped apart by the hedge fund. This was all very public. And, you know, we were constantly thinking, while we were dealing with the cyber attack, is this something else that we're going to have to deal with? The managing directors for both that company and Finabler, was the parent of Travelex, were brothers. They were backed by the same Indian billionaire. This is all in the public domain, but I won't mention any names. And, you know, naturally, people drew the conclusion that, well, whatever's happening at NMC Health is also happening at Travelex's parent at Finabler. There was, you know, distinct statements made to try and counter that. The hedge fund then moved the spotlight to Travelex's parent, that owned about five or six other companies like TravelX. And sure enough, they found errors and misrepresentations in the financials, and it turned out the same thing was happening. And it was done through a sophisticated supply chain finance arrangement. Bank accounts were being set up that auditors didn't have any knowledge over. Funds were being skimmed off payments and going into these unknown bank accounts. These are all off balance sheet. And, you know, I don't know, to be honest, but I still think this is a legal case is being pursued by the banks that were involved. And of course, the banks that lent to our parent were all on the hook for pretty sizable sums in terms of the credit facility offered to that parent. And, like I said, I don't know. I'm not up to speed with it, but I think there's still legal investigations going in on this. So we immediately found that, you know, that in a different way was hitting our credit worthiness as an entity. The cyber attack, you know, nearly took us down. We nearly had to switch the lights out as early as January, February time. But then the fraud became public knowledge. The banks then behaved quite differently. They found that, you know, there was questions over whether TravelX was a going concern without parent support if the parent was liquidated, for example. So, yeah, the bank spoke to us very differently then. We had some banks withdraw support completely. I was running a treasury team for an FX company with just one FX line with one bank. All our credit facilities were withdrawn. We had an intraday facility that luckily I was able to negotiate, but it meant that liquidity, when we really thought it couldn't get any worse in January, was tightened even more. And, you know, we had the systems up and running again, but at the same time, we were doing working capital and cash management, cash forecasting, you know, almost on an hourly basis to keep the wheels going round. That was February 2020. So I think what happened the next month. Yeah, so Boris got on the TV and explained what lockdown was to all of us. What was that? I think it's ingrained in my head. Was it March the 17th, I think? Maybe the 25th?
Yeah, COVID, March 2020.
And we all had our last day in the office for, again, we didn't know how long we'd be at home. So very quickly it became clear that, as you said at the beginning, that the travel in the tourism industry was intrinsic to TravelX. You know, you heard stories of EasyJet, BA furloughing and getting rid of 50% of their staff within a few weeks. All planes were grounded. You know, travel was non-existent for months. You know, again, I think it goes back to the personal side of this. At times of crisis, it's very hard to try to bring along your team with everything you're doing because you know a lot of information or you're privy to a lot of information that you just simply can't share. You know, again, it's 4 years ago. I can't remember exactly. But within 10 weeks, we had 90% of our revenues evaporate. And you can't run a company like that in a normal way. It just becomes, you know, you have to do the absolute bare minimum. There was an email, when email started working again, an email going around from HR asking people to volunteer for unpaid leave. That was one example of just how drastic it got to try and keep a control of that cost base as much as possible. Sadly, I had to tell my team, you know, we're all going to take a 20% pay cut. We did that for 4 months. Later on, probably April, May time, I had to put half of my team on notice, and then six of those, sadly, were made redundant, one being there for over 30 years. And, of course, all of that was done over Zoom calls, very impersonal. I would never wish that on my worst enemy doing that. That was a pretty grim time when I had to have those conversations. But, you know, it's just bringing to light the fact we had to do some massively drastic things to try and reduce that cost base to really prevent 11,000 people losing their job. You know, again, I can go into more of this if you want, but I'm conscious I'm rattling on a bit now. But
no, that's all. I mean, like, tell me, so again, from a treasury perspective, right, you lose 90% of your revenue. How do you keep things going? Like, what was your cash situation at that time? How close did you get to bankruptcy? And how did you avoid it?
So I'll answer that question with the frame of the period from March to June 2020. It's really those 3 months were absolutely critical. As I said, cash forecasting became the number one task within the company. It was so, scrutiny over that was, you know, laser focused. It had the CEO chairing the meetings, all the senior leadership and the key people involved in that process. If anything, all the information the company generated was all to plug into a cash forecast to make sure we had, you know, as much certainty over cash flows as possible. And anyone listening to this knows that cash flow forecasting, I always say, in any company is done badly. It's just done badly in different ways in different companies. It's a hard thing to do. You can control your payments, but it's very hard to control your receivables, you know. So again, you prioritize, you think, right, what do I absolutely have to pay? You have to pay your staff. You have to pay HMRC for tax. There's contractual payments. Those type of things have to be top of the list. And I'm not exaggerating. Every afternoon, we would go through and prioritize which payments went out that day. The group CFO had to authorize that, and then it would we would release those payments the following day to make those. But of course, you know, even that was incredibly tight, and hence the reason for the redundancies. Sadly, we closed the entire US division. That was 3,500 people lost their jobs that had been in the US market for over 30 years, I think. You know, as the responsibility of the directors, they had to continue the company as a going concern as much as possible. In the end, we had to put into what's called a pre-pack administration process the main trading entity, and then transition across everything from one Travelex entity to another, with the one that was remaining basically did go into administration. So that cut off creditors, that seriously annoyed a lot of very long-standing creditors as well. But it was either that or completely turn the lights out. So again, a massively difficult decision for the directors at that point. And the operational side of this, and you know, I relay it to my team now, and they still don't believe me, I don't think. But if you think about it, you've got all those bank accounts in that trading entity. That trading entity doesn't exist anymore. What do you have to do? You have to open bank accounts in the new entity. I still think this must be a world record, but we opened 120-odd bank accounts in about 4 weeks. I think it might have been a little shorter time than that. And, you know, anyone in Treasury now, KYC and everything else, it takes weeks and weeks just to open one bank account normally.
Now, which bank is letting you open accounts with FX company in the peak of COVID? How did you swing that? Like, let alone trying to convince a bank to give you an account, you had 120.
And to be honest, Sam, I never even thought about that at that time. It was really, you know, go into crisis management rescue mode. But the bank was Barclays, and it was our only key banking provider. The others had left. And, you know, they had that or the other option of the company winding up and they lose everything. As I said before, we were a gold-plated client, and you know, certainly their return on us as a customer was very good. They wanted to keep Travelex as a customer and still do. So that was, you know, I imagine there were senior exec conversations even in Barclays to allow that to happen, but that's how we got it done in the end. And then really to go to the end of that June period, in short, the bondholders, where that was the main source of funding for the company, the bondholders became the new owners. They took a massive haircut on their lending to the company. And I think some new parties came involved as well. But effectively, that raised, I won't say the number, but it was tens of millions. There was a considerable chunk of that taken out to pay all the advisors and the consultants. But it was enough to keep the working capital within the company and really continue the wheels going and fueling the company in terms of putting it to value and building the company back up again. And it was that close that we nearly turned the lights out that summer. And if you remember, you know, people had never, A, been through a pandemic before, B, I think the summer was really good as well, and C, the concept of working from home, some people absolutely loved it. You know, they could spend more time with their children, maybe some didn't want to do that. They could clock off early, they could enjoy the really good weather, and it was a whole different world. And I made sure, personally, I kept my head level and kept my feet on the ground by, you know, seeing friends regularly when we were permitted to. And it was always interesting hearing their side of the world to what my side of the world was. I'm not trying to play the victim, but it kept things in perspective. I thought, you know, you could have all these bank calls, all these lawyers calls, these really grim conversations. But at the end of the day, you know, there's more important things in life. Keep your feet on the ground and you talk to your friends, your family, my immediate family. I think you might remember when we last spoke, my wife had a baby only the year before. So we had a 9-month-year-old and a 3-year-old. It was them that made me keep perspective on things.
That's super interesting. I guess, indeed, as a leader of an organization at the time, your personal mental health and how grounded you are and your personal, let's say, internal state is going to drive a lot of the way that you interact with your staff, the way that the sympathy that you have when you are having those difficult conversations, and the perspective that you've put yourself in when you're having those as well. And then also the strength to be able to step up and guide during that very rough time. What did you learn were your key leadership takeaways through all of that?
It's one word, it's communication. It's how you communicate and how frequently, what words you use, your tone, and how you really get some quite difficult situations expressed to your team about how we should go forwards and what we should do next. And as I said, as a leader as well, you were privy to a lot of information you couldn't possibly share with your team that actually probably would have painted a lot worse picture. So it was about being able to filter.
Can you give us an example? What's an example of that?
The fact we paid the ransom, the fact that we couldn't really trust what we were going to get back in terms of encrypted information, the uncertainty about how that would all pan out, the inner workings of the fraud at the parent. I mean, there were lots of people asking, what really happened, Matt? I couldn't tell them then. And, equally, I think ignorance was bliss in a way, because the team were very good. They kept on with the BAU, the operations, and really that stoicism just to keep the wheels going. If they knew, I think it was June the 11th, again, another date ingrained on me, that morning we had a call with all the advisors, all the legal team, just to understand what is the possibility we're going to have to turn the lights out and liquidate or put this company into administration, and that's it. You can't tell the team that, but you've got to give them a sense of urgency to do that, extra level of cash forecasting, extra diligence with payments, because we suddenly still work into manual methods. They have to trust you, and you don't get that trust overnight. You have to build that anyway. That goes without saying. But they have to trust you. They probably know you know more than them, but you can't tell them everything. So it is just down to one word, trust, isn't it? It's how you respect each other, I think.
I still understand how people still had energy by the end of it. I don't understand how you had the energy by the end of it. But I guess, you said that you were grounded. You just had your wife just had a baby. You had perspective in your life to keep you going. How did you distill that to your team? How did you get the team of a core operation, right, to maintain trust in you as a leader? Because you, at the end of the day, in their eyes, are an extension of the company.
Correct.
A representative of the company, a representative of the leadership that allowed a cyber attack to happen, that was facing how that was being treated at the time, that was not privy to, but involved in the organization where fraud had occurred. And COVID, okay, fine, that's completely out of your control. But a lot of people weren't happy about it. And you had to impose the lockdowns, which you said a lot of people enjoyed. A lot of people hated it. A lot of people went through entirely terrible mental health through that as well. How did you keep them going through that time?
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, it all boils down to, I like to think I'm reasonably transparent and honest. I think if people...
But you couldn't be. That was even worse.
Yeah, well, to the extent that they think I am, but you're right, there was information I couldn't share. It's a bit counterintuitive what I'm about to say, but in your typical management style, I think if people find out you're withholding information, then trust could erode quite quickly. What was important and what I could share, I always shared quickly, and that generated a mindset of transparency and honesty. And I think if people realise that you're not there to play games or, get involved in power struggles or anything like that, then people usually trust you. And I think at the same time there was a stoicism to keep the company going, which really helped me, but also it was about focusing on the little wins as well. So we got an intraday credit facility agreed with Barclays one day. That was a really good day. That it was daft in a way, that would be quite trivial otherwise. We were able to get systems back online, we were able to get our derivative trading back to where it used to be. It was about, recognizing those little gains and celebrating them in a little way without being patronizing, of course. But I think more importantly, it's about the underlying mindset and keeping an open, transparent environment, really, which is easier said than done. But obviously, hopefully I did that before the cyber attack in the 9 months I was at the company anyway. And equally, you know, I remember our CEO used to say, this whole process will be like walking across a desert and you don't know when you're next going to find water. And you've just got to keep putting one foot forward and the next one and just keep going. And eventually you will get there as long as you just don't give up. And isn't that a bit of a life lesson as well? That I think I said to Graham, it was a line in Rocky, wasn't it? It's not how hard you get hit, it's or how often you get hit. It's about keeping moving forward and keep with a mindset that you will get over this crisis or whatever it is. You've got to never give up is, I think, quite a strong thing in my mantra in life, really. But I think just to finish off, I think really you've also got to keep a sense of humour. You can't ever have complete, you know, formal, stern mindset about all of this all the time. You've got to be able to laugh at yourself as well. And equally, you know, there's always going to be side conversations and there's a danger there you could have a toxic environment start. So you've got to nip those in the bud quite quickly, but then that goes back to your management style and how you do that. You can't treat people like children because then they behave like children. You've got to talk to them like adults. But I think going back to that other point, keeping a sense of humour is pretty important as well, and not taking yourself too seriously.
I think the one thing I liked about what you said there was that you'd laid the groundwork for the management through that cyber attack, through that financial crime, through the COVID in the first 9 months. It wasn't during then. During then is when you show your true colours, I'm sure. But you'd already laid so much groundwork that allowed people to trust you in a time when that's, I guess, what they really needed. And again, to get people to band together, not everyone can do that, Matt. So definitely hats off to you to manage to get through all of that. And I think it makes a really interesting story now.
Yeah. And this was at a time when, you know, we'd be working, maybe the more senior people, 50, 60, 70-hour weeks, you know, a lot of weekend working. And really that continued for, people can withstand that for a few weeks or maybe a month, but we were doing that. My first day off was September the 15th that year when I said, right, I'm definitely going to take the family away. Yeah, I mean, if you told someone you'd do that, they'd simply say, no, I'm not doing that. But in a way, it brings back that survival instinct as a human being. You get through it somehow. You keep on fighting, you keep on taking each day as it comes. You keep celebrating those little wins and you keep your eye on the goal to, you know, where you want to get to. That's important, I think. That was a bit philosophical, sorry.
No, that was amazing. That's exactly what it's all about. Matt, I don't think I want to spoil it by asking any more questions than that. I think that's a lovely place to end it off. Is there anything else you'd like to add about how treasurers and treasury functions specifically? Any advice specifically to treasurers for dealing with any black swan event, let alone three in a row?
That's a question everyone will ask. It's a big question, hard to say in a few sentences. I mean, really, keep a level head, keep your sense of humour, keep calm as much as you can do. Always realise you've got to filter out the information you know and what you relay to your team or your immediate stakeholders. And, you know, empathise as much as you can. You know, I often thought, if I was my treasury dealer, if I was my front office manager, what are they thinking? I know them reasonably well. I know if they've got a family or children or not. What's their main concern? Try and put yourself in other people's shoes. And then really, the point I kept saying, communication is absolutely key. If you relate it to crisis management with the armed services or the emergency response services, you know, I'm sure they'd say the same, that instruction and communication is absolutely key in making sure that you get the right behaviours. So that's normally keeping it very brief and succinct and very clear what the message is.
Sounds great. Matt, thank you so much. So tell us a little, you didn't touch on it. What are you working at now? I know you're not at TravelX anymore. Tell us a bit about Chubb, what you're doing there, and what your current treasury role looks like. Hopefully a lot more relaxed.
Yeah, definitely. I wouldn't say relaxed, but exciting in a different way. Yeah, sorry, I thought at the beginning I should do this. But so my current role, I'm the head of treasury operations for EMEA, for Chubb. Chubb is not the lot company, it's the other one. It's the largest property and casualty insurer in the world. A very large, with about a 90-plus billion market cap. Actually a Swiss headquartered company, but it's mainly based in the US, but a presence in about 55 countries. And alongside my role as head of treasury ops, I'm also the global process owner for our treasury payment architecture. And that is essentially a payment factory / payment hub arrangement where we have straight through processing from the front end system all the way through a centralized payment hub, a series of in-house banks, and then the payment out to the beneficiaries. So we try to model that in as many countries and areas as we can. We've got that in about 35 of the 54 countries we're in. So my job is to enforce and, you know, make sure that architecture is followed and ensure that deployments meet that as much as we can to our treasury standard, if we can call it that. So we've been on a, I hate the word, but a journey for about 12 years in implementing this transformation program. And certainly there's more to do on that. And that's really keeps my job very interesting, going back to the original point about variety. But it also means I have to stay at the forefront of payment and receivables technology, for example. That keeps it very fresh. I think technology is moving very quickly at the moment. And that's on top of all the normal treasury operations. So cash management, liquidity management, forecasting FX risk, that type of thing.
Awesome. Matt, if people want to find out more about you or get in touch, where should they go? Just LinkedIn's the best place or anywhere else specifically?
Yeah, LinkedIn's absolutely fine. And, you know, certainly have people contacting me through that. I'm always fine with that platform.
Sounds great. Well, make sure we have a link in the show notes below. Matt, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Okay. Thanks a lot for your time.